So, we were talking about the Rolling Stones tomorrow night. That was originally on the schedule, and I even promoted it last night on with George, talking about the life of Brian Jones, or more specifically, the death of Brian Jones, and who is responsible for that, and that they had had a real difficult time for a long time to proving that it was murder, to become one of those rock and roll mysteries. Well, it has actually been recategorized as a homicide in England, and the guy who was originally scheduled to be on the show tomorrow night was the man who was kind of the one to trip the first domino in that investigation. Well, his lawyer said no, and we were scheduled to have him on, but the lawyer said he couldn't come on yet. And that there were some details to work out. So we'll put that on hold for now. We'll look forward to getting him back on again sometime soon. But tomorrow night, that does open up a little bit more time to be talking about the nearly departed. And if you think about a story of actual ghostly encounters in the upper Midwest, you may be thinking to yourself, well, so that's a, so what? Well, unusual ones, and ones you've never heard of before, and the legends themselves are enough to make you sort of rethink the world around you. That's coming up tomorrow night, The Nearly Departed, on Sunday night on Coast to Coast. In the meantime, rethinking the world all around you in terms of numbers. You can't help but read the math book by Dr. Cliff Pickover and not become, John Nash. In your own way, right? The subject of A Beautiful Mind, where suddenly you're seeing numbers and letters and formations everywhere. Maybe you'll come up with your own theorem after you read about the 250 greatest discoveries in math. It's a great book, and we'll get back to some of my favorites before we start taking your calls coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. All right, so where were we, Cliff Pickover?
We're going through some milestones.
Okay.
Would you like to?
Was there one in particular? Did I leave you hanging on one?
I think we finished up. So, there's a nice one called Hilbert's Grand Hotel. I don't know if that was an interesting one dealing with infinity. I'm very interested in the topic of infinity because that almost goes beyond math and talks about what are the limits of our thoughts. And there's a lot of, we've gone a long way from number. Numbers started out maybe counting sheep in the. Fields 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then gradually the concept of number came to encompass different levels of infinity, and that's always mind-boggling.
Well, and I think even just, it's interesting that the concept of infinity at one point didn't exist. It didn't mean that infinity didn't exist, but that we didn't have a name for it. When did we actually label infinity?
Well, I don't know the exact date, but what mathematically I think was fascinating is that they've discovered there are different levels of infinity. So you would think, well, infinity is infinity. How could there be
Right.
one infinity greater than another infinity?
Exactly.
But in mathematics, there was a guy named Cantor, which he worked on this idea, and he proved that there are different levels of the infinite, which is really mind-boggling.
I still don't get that. How could there be different levels of the, it's either infinite or it's not, isn't it?
Well, that's the Hilbert Grand Hotel entry is interesting because it gets at this counterintuitive notion. If you go into a normal hotel, let's say it has 300 rooms,
Right.
the desk clerk says, each room is occupied, and he says, we're sorry, the rooms are filled, you can't have a room. But in Hilbert's hotel, which is a hypothetical hotel, there's an infinite number of rooms. And even if they're all filled with people, where they're all occupied, you go into a room, you go to the desk clerk, and he says, oh, no problem, I can get you a room. So he sends the guy in room 1 to room 2, the guy in room 2 to room 3, etc., moves him up, and then room 1 is now open for you. So it's an example of counterintuitive nature infinity. The hotel was filled, but you can see an algorithm where he can make room for you. And it's very mind-stretching. In
But at
fact,
the same,
you could shove an infinite number of people in that hotel by putting everyone in, moving them to the even-numbered room, to the odd-numbered rooms, and things of that nature, and you could keep shoving in people.
well, it, I always want to see that one get tested. I mean, I like. I mean, it's easy enough to say that, but it's no, you're no longer dealing with a finite space like a 300-room hotel.
Exactly. You really can't test it. It's pure. mathematics. And but you're right, it's such a shocking idea that Cantor, when he was talking about these infinities and levels of infinities, a lot of mathematicians really criticized him. He had suffered from severe depression and was institutionalized. But he said that he was a reporter of God's ideas. He said, look, you know, you're criticizing my idea, but this magnifies God. Power would be diminished if he only dealt with finite numbers. So
right,
he had religion in him.
Well, I respect that. But again, it comes back to sort of that pattern within mathematicians, people who are looking for patterns within life. The pattern is that some of these guys led these really troubled lives, and yet they came up with these amazing things, or that they had really kind of troubled personalities. Very few of them strike me as people who are sort of like happily married and had kids and did their job and came home again. They just had these sort of extraordinary, sometimes weird kind of, at least by my mind, structures in their life.
Right. We have to be careful not to take it too far, because we remember the weird stories. We don't remember the mathematicians who are pretty normal.
But well, looking in your book of subset of mathematicians in your book. Like, who's the one? Is it Boole? That where he and his wife were both mathematicians?
Yeah, Boole was interested in Boolean algebra, which is zeros and ones, and that's useful for today's computer.
Binary system, right?
Yes, you're right. But there was Mary Boole, who was his wife, and she wrote a book called Philosophy in Front of Algebra, and it gives a nice glimpse into what math education was like in the 1900s. Especially at a time when women, you know, were not allowed to have university positions. You see, there are a few stories of women in here that sort of boggle the mind of how hard it was for women to go into mathematics, because, you know, the prejudice was so great back then.
But there you go. So you're just talking about Boole, and here's Boolean. Was it Boolean algebra? Is that what it was? There's Boole. He's got to be one of the few mathematicians at that level who could come home and talk about his work to his wife, whose eyes wouldn't totally glass over the second he started talking about theorems and conjectures.
Yeah, that was an interesting couple. He reduced logic just to basically zeros and ones and operations like but that formed the basis of telephone switching, and now computers are all, you know, run on binary code, so it paved a nice way for the future.
Well, and it also, I think it kind of, in a way, brings us to fuzzy logic, which I think people use that term a lot, but I don't know that they use it accurately.
Yeah, that was developed in the mid-60s. And, with logic, you think it's one or another, or, you know, it's you're a member of this set, or you're a member of that set. But this is a fuzzy thing where you had a continuous range of truth values, where you can be partially in this set or that set. And it does have practical values in odd places, like washing machines that can use fuzzy logic to operate more efficiently, or engine controls, or even, I think, self-focusing cameras. But it's called fuzzy logic because it has this continuous range of truth values. It's not really true or false. It's sort of, 70% true. And
right,
based on this logic, it had some practical use.
It's sort of a practical version of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, isn't it? The idea that two things could occupy the same space at the same time, I don't know.
Yeah, the fuzziness is there. The Heisenberg is more of a physics thing, where we say if you have a particle, you can't know both its speed and its position at the same time. If you know too much about one, you don't know much about the other. So you're right, there is a little fuzziness in that aspect.
It seems a little fuzzy logic. We're talking with Dr. Cliff Pickover. The book is The Math Book, and it goes over the 250 milestones in the history of mathematics. One of these photographs I love here, this beautiful painting of Prince Rupert's problem. What was Prince Rupert's problem, other than that ginormous hat he was wearing?
Yeah, that was from around, he was in the 1600s, but his problem was solved in the 1800s, or at least, solution was published. It had to do with a wager about the largest cube, you can pass through another cube. So let's try to visualize that. Let's say you have a wooden cube 1 inch on its edge. Well, can you actually squeeze or drill a hole into that would fit another one-inch hole, a one-inch cube, you know, sort of put one through the other. And the solution that was published in 1800 showed that, yes, you can. In fact, you can put a cube with an edge of one, a little more than 1 inch in the right way. You can shove it through the original cube with 1 inch. That's the Prince Rupert's problem. It was a wager about what's the largest cube you can pass through another one.
Well, there's the Ian Punnett's problem, but I hate the idea that it won't be solved until 100 years after my death. Then so what? You know, that doesn't actually solve my problem. We were talking about how mathematics is the key to understanding other dimensions. What about time travel? You know, that's one of those things. I was actually thinking about time travel the other day with another movie that's coming out based on that. And time travel movies are always problematic for me, you know, and how well they deal with the dimensions of time travel, to me, will dictate how well the story works. But so what do we know? What can we actually know about time travel based on mathematics?
Well, we seem to be living in a universe that have these three large spatial dimensions and one dimension of time. But we know that physicists have shown that time travel is actually real in many ways of doing it. The easiest way, at least theoretically, is travel into the future. So if you get into a rocket ship and go out at very high speed and come back to Earth, you will have traveled into the future, maybe 10 years, maybe 100 years, 1,000 years. It has to do with one of Einstein's theory of relativity. And then there are other Einsteinian ideas where you show how gravity can warp time. Now, backwards time travel is a little more hard than this forwards one, but there's been all sorts of neat physical ways that's been proposed to create time machines that make use of wormholes and gravity, and they don't seem to disobey the laws of physics. And often what you find is if physics doesn't prohibit something from happening, eventually we actually discover it. So it's an interesting area, time travel.
What's the closest anybody's ever come to that, to time travel? Has anybody ever achieved even going 1 second faster into the future?
Definitely. In fact, there was a neat experiment where these guys said, look, the equations are nice, so let's try to prove it. And they took these atomic clocks aboard an airplane, and they compared, and so the airplane's moving at a high speed, relative to one on the ground. And they showed, as the airplane was going around the Earth, that the time, they aged less, the time slowed down for them. Now, the effect was very small, but if you could go at higher speeds, the effect could become greater and greater.
Okay, wait, so they aged less by, even at a fraction of a second, but they aged less. How is that time travel?
Well, they're traveling into the future. Let me see, put it this way. There's something called the twin paradox. Let's say there's two Ians. One Ian stays on Earth, and one goes out on a high-speed rocket and comes back, and the old Ian on Earth is 80 years old, and then this Ian's coming back into the future because he's aged slower than the Earth has aged. See what I'm saying? So the Earth is going along at one click of the clock, and the Ian who had traveled out and came back, his clock was slower, so he's actually coming into the Earth's future in a relative sort of way.
In a relative sort of way. And I guess part of that, too, I mean, that's interesting, but no one's ever been able to go forward into the same space. So that, for example, to use the book The Time Machine, where you could end up with the time machine stayed in one place. It traveled through time, but it stayed in one place. And when he came out of it in the future, he was in the same building that he had been in the past. But the building was now decayed and covered with vines, and all of London had changed around him, but he had never left. And we've never been able to do, and there's not even like 1 second worth of that kind of time travel, has there been?
Yeah, you're right. Most of the physicists' methods of time travel deals with going through wormholes or going at high speeds or going close to high gravitating bodies like black holes, which we know that gravity, by the way, slows time down. So time in your basement is slower than on your roof, but the effect is so minuscule, it's not, you wouldn't really want to call it time travel by going up to their roof or their basement.
Hey, right.
By the way, would you, if you had the option of going into the future, the past, and staying there, which would you think you'd prefer? But on the condition you had to stay there once you arrived.
Right. Do we get to pick the place, the time?
Yes.
Okay. So if we have the Wayback Machine, right? If you're Mr. Peabody and you're going to send me in the Wayback Machine, I go back, not forward.
Yeah. Or you would go back in time.
I would go back in time, not forward.
Yeah, I'm thinking. I'm not sure what your listeners would think, but I could see both going into the future. I'd like, because they'd cure all the medical diseases. You probably medicine would be amazing. But of course, there's some risks. And of course, if you went back in time, you could probably think of all these nifty ways of making money. I'm guessing you probably want to visit some interesting historical happenings.
Yeah, I'd be curious how. I think the interesting part would be, if nothing else, for the satisfaction of my own curiosity, to go to certain events and just see how they actually happened. And then even if it meant staying there for all time, even if it meant not being able to go back into the present time and report on what I saw, I would at least be able to scratch that itch once
right.
and for all.
It gives you the satisfaction of knowing.
I'd be afraid if I went into the future. Honestly, I've thought of this. I'd be afraid if I went into the future, I would be, it would be like the equivalent of a Western European landing on the shores of a sort of more native North America and infecting people with the common cold, where thousands of people might die. I have no idea how they might be affected by my presence in the future.
Because I know what you're saying, but also think about going back in time. Medicine was so primitive.
But that's the thing.
Women was primitive.
The ability I might have to survive the past, I'm afraid I could live with. I'd be afraid of going into the future and being the Typhoid Mary of the future. You know what I mean? And bringing all these things that they had cured, and suddenly I would be bringing them back like some flea-infested rat, you know, from a ship bringing bubonic plague back. You know what I mean?
Sure, you probably were fearful of war. We don't really know what the future holds. It's such an unknown.
Well, are we going? We have to. Okay, so we'll come back. It's the math book, Clifford Pickover, From Pythagoras to the 57th Dimension, 250 Milestones in the History of Mathematics on Coast to Coast AM. Really? There's been... Oh, you know what? This has happened before. I swear to God, this has just happened. Cliff Pickover, we were just talking about time travel. And I have one of these atomic clocks in the studio where I'm broadcasting from. And every so once in a while, it goes forward in time a couple of minutes. It gets uncoordinated with the overall clock. So now that I'm looking at my clock up on the wall versus my clock on my computer, I can see that there's a minute disparity, but it happened right during that time when we were talking about time travel.
Must be that fuzzy logic.
I'm telling you, that is a weird little coincidence. It's happened before where I was going into a break and I went to a break early because the atomic clock flipped forward. Well, then for the rest of the night, I can't trust that atomic clock for whatever reason. It just sped forward a couple of minutes, so I'll just go by the one that's on my laptop. And sorry about that. Sorry for scaring you back in the studio. But I was just looking up going, oh, I got to go. Well, there you go. The universe is playing a little joke on me. 250 of the most intriguing mathematical milestones in history. We haven't gotten to the stuff you're curious about, but I want to get back to some of the things like Rouleau's triangle or the Peano curve and Sylvester's line problem, and other things that we learn from to this day on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. So many things to get to in the 250 milestones in the history of mathematics. Like, what is the birthday paradox?
The birthday paradox is something that's probably counterintuitive. It's saying, how many people can you get in a room so that there's about a 50% chance that a pair have the same birthday?
Okay, and yet, how does that explain anything that violates the laws of probability? I mean, doesn't that make perfect sense?
Well, it doesn't violate the laws. It just gives you an idea about it's so interesting because it talks about what is really coincidence, what is pure math. Well, I'll give you the answer. If you have 23 people in a room, that's all you need to have a greater than a 50% chance that a pair have the same birthday. You know, maybe that sounds counterintuitive, but it was interesting because in 1939, people started throwing out this paradox just as the way of looking at things that might seem to be coincidence, but really the laws of probability say that's what you need. 23 people in a room to have a greater than 50% chance that a pair have the same birthday.
Well, that's just part of it. We'll get to more coming up with the math book next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, in the math book with Dr. Clifford Pickover, there are some, you know, milestones in the history of mathematics that sound more dramatic and interesting than they turn out, I think. The Mobius function. I had high hopes for the Mobius function. And I thought, okay, so it was a little bit of a letdown. Can you explain the Mobius function?
Well, the Mobius function that's a theoretical and a number theory. I think the Mobius strip, what do you think? That seems more interesting to me. That the Mobius strip is that it's just a strip of paper. You give it a half twist, tape it together, and it only has one side. If you take a red crayon and try to color one side red and one side green with a green crayon, you just can't do it. And it's amazing that no one else really described the properties of the Mobius strip till 1858.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of cool. I liked that. I was interested too in the pigeonhole principle, which also seems like a fairly simple idea that wasn't identified until the 19th century. Describe the pigeonhole principle.
Yeah, that all the things we're talking about have pictures associated with them, and that has a nice photo of a pigeonhole house with all these pigeons going in and out. Well, it sounds trivial. It says if you have N pigeons and M homes, if N is greater than M, at least one home must house more than a pigeon. Let me say that more easily. If you have a certain number of holes and there's more pigeons than there are holes, then some holes are going to have more than one pigeon in it.
Well, if you had eight families living on a block, but there were only seven houses on the block, it had to be that one of those families shares a house with another family.
Right. Now, that sounds kind of trivial. Right? Who cares about
right.
pigeonhole?
Exactly.
But there's some really two really cool things that as examples of where it lets you reason better. So, for example, using the pigeonhole principle, we can say that at least two people in New York City have exactly the same number of hairs on their head. How do we do that?
Now, how can we say that with certainty?
We can say it because of the pigeonhole principle. And it has to do with this. Let's consider each hair like a pigeonhole, and the people are pigeons. There are less than a million hairs on the head. There are more than 8 million people in New York City. And by the pigeonhole principle, that means you're going to have some people with exactly the same number of hairs on their head. Same type of thing.
Now, how does that help us? What do we learn from the pigeonhole principle? What does it ever give us in life?
Well, it lets you reason in a nice way once it becomes second nature. Like another one is, let's say you take a piece of paper, and I say, Ian, you can color red or blue on any complicated paint job you want. Due to the pigeonhole principle, I can say, I can guarantee that there's two points of the same, I can always find two points of the same color an inch apart, no matter how you crazily color the bill. The reason is, using the pigeonhole principle, you can draw an equilateral triangle, you know, let's say with 1 inch on each edge, and the colors are pigeonholes, the vertices of the triangle or the corner are pigeons, and so you're going to have one of those lines of the triangle is going to have to connect two points of the same color.
Okay.
So, yet to make a long story short, it's a very trivial-sounding thing, but lets mathematicians reason in certain ways.
Well, is there any mathematical formula that can help me win one of those guess-how-many-marbles-there-are-in-a-jar contest? Now, give me a practical application for math in that sense. If I'm looking at one of these jars and it says, let's say it's all filled with M&Ms. Is there any of your mathematical equations, greatest of all time kind of thing, that could help me understand, help me get an accurate guess and help me win the jar?
Well, there's sort of simple math. You can estimate the volume of the jar. You can estimate the volume of the M&Ms. In fact, I have a picture of that spherical jar with M&Ms in it. And these researchers looked at the packing density, like how packed can the M&Ms get? You know, how much space is there? And that's part of a very old conjecture with spheres. I don't know if you consider that all practical, but you know, it's an interesting application of math, looking at the packing density. In other words, how many balls or oranges can you fit into a crate? How many M&Ms can you fit into a sphere? People have thought about that sort of thing for over hundreds of years.
Yeah, well, and I'm thinking about it right now. So, I mean, the only way I've ever been able to do something like that is to count the levels that I see, you know, to give a rough estimate of the number of levels that I see of the M&Ms in the jar, and then to try to get a count for how many M&Ms would be on a typical level. And so it's very sort of time consuming, and there's a lot of guesstimation involved. And I was just curious whether there was anybody had ever come up, there'd been like, you know, true false M&M principle or anything where somebody had come up with a way to win those.
Yeah, I'm sure there are nice recipes out there for calculating based on, you know, the shape of the container. Is it a cylinder? Is it a sphere? I mean, in the book, the researchers actually did research that said that the M&Ms have a packing density of about 68%, which means they pack more tightly than spheres. And I'm sure there's some way you could probably use that to help, you know, because it tells you how much air is in between the M&Ms.
Right, right. Now, as you're preparing the math book, Cliff, what was the weirdest thing you came across? Of the 250 milestones in the history of mathematics, what's the one you consider to be the most out there?
Well, I think the bedsheet problem, 2001, is pretty cool. It's weird or fun because a high school student was involved in solving some of it. The problem starts out with, imagine a bedsheet. Let's say it's a 0.4 millimeter, you know, very thin. How many folds would I have to fold that bedsheet to make a distance from the Earth to the moon? In other words, I fold 0.4 millimeters, I fold in half, becomes 0.8. It doubles, and then get double and double and double. Anyway, the remarkable thing about that is you have to fold it only 40 times, and you'd sleep on the moon because it would get that thick. Now, that's the starting point for the bedsheet problem. What this woman did for the bedsheet problem is attack the problem of how many times you could fold a sheet of paper in half.
Right.
And the prevailing wisdom all through the 1900s that you can only fold the paper in half, in this, let's say in the same direction, 7 or 8 times. You could try it for yourself. That's the best you could do.
Right.
But this, in 2002, this high school student folded this thing 12 times, which defeated all wisdom. And then she came up with a formula that actually said, you know, how much material you lose on the edge of the fold, and it tells you really what's the limit to how much you can fold something. So it's a very fun application of math, and it's interesting that a high school student was developing all this stuff so recently.
Well, I like that. Now, is there anything that in any era that anybody has come up with to try to estimate the likelihood of life on other planets, or the possibility of aliens being amongst us?
Yeah, alien life is very interesting to contemplate, and people do think about probabilities for that. And the way I look at it is this: you know, everywhere you look on Earth, in the most bizarre environments, in boiling water, and miles under the Earth in darkness, and in ice, you know, you actually find life. Saying that, you know, what's possible tends to be realized in nature. So, personally, I think that the universe, you know, the visible universe that we can see, probably has lots of life. The question is, are we talking about primitive life, or technological life. Now, technological life might be much rarer, you know, life with spaceships zooming around the galaxy. But I think some form of life is probably everywhere.
Well, I like that. Go back over that again, that idea that if it seems possible, it's likely to be. Is that what, am I summing you up right?
It seems that way. Like if what we see on Earth is that life is everywhere. You know, if it can exist there, it is there.
That goes back to Antarctica and some of these discoveries they're making of these whole ecosystems in ice or below ice that somehow have managed it and they're thriving and they're below like a mile of ice and there's life.
Yeah, it is truly amazing. But, you know, intelligent life forms and technological life might not be inevitable, even given billions of years of evolution. Because, you know, if you look at the Earth, 50 billion species arose, but only one, us, acquired the technology. And in some ways, you might even say mammals aren't necessarily the most successful because 95% of the species are invertebrates, animals without backbones. So who knows if intelligent life is easy to evolve or not?
Yeah, and you could even make the argument that as successful as human beings are, or mammals for that matter, that we still can't survive in the largest ecosystems on the planet. We can't survive at ocean depths. We can't survive at altitudes that other animals can.
Right. We're pretty sensitive creatures. And in fact, if you want to go into outer space, you need two things. You need intelligence, but you also need manual dexterity, like with your hands, to manipulate parts. And you see on Earth, you have smart dolphins and, let's say, dexterous spiders, but the spiders aren't so smart. And the dolphins can't really manipulate their environment. So that might be another difficult thing to overcome to get spacefaring creatures zooming around the galaxies.
Well, I like that. And I think that's true even when we talk about just the geography of Earth and just the possibilities in the history of the vulcanization of Earth and how the moon affected all of us, that to borrow the expression, the planets lined up just right for there to be life on Earth, which is really just a big giant math problem. That if you had infinite number of Earth's moons, but at different distances from the sun, would there have been life if we were, you know, X number of miles closer or X number of miles further away, or if there hadn't been a moon, or if, and then fill in the blank, what the variety of other possibilities are that would not have led us to be able to sustain life on this planet.
Exactly. There seems to be so many cosmic coincidences. You know, life depends on carbon, and that's based on some of these very fine tuning of nuclear reactions in the sun. And if the universe exploded just a little bit faster, there'd be no stars forming. And if it after the Big Bang, it exploded just a little bit slower, it would just recollapse and there would be no life, no stars. So that fine-tuning is very interesting.
Well, doesn't that lead us to at least wonder about the mathematics of the divine? Is there a way in which math can be applied to prove that or disprove that there's a God?
Well, that gets you close to the God concept. I mean, some people say there's a multiverse with infinite number of parallel universes, and we just happen to be on the one that has all the parameters tuned. But you're right. A lot of people think, does this show some kind of evidence of this? Does the fine-tuning indicate something more, some intelligence?
You know, yeah, I'm banking on a multiverse because I want to think that in some other dimension, I've got a jump shot.
In fact, you know, serious physicists, really, majority of them believe in some kind of multiverse or different numbers of parallel universes. So it's not that far out or science fiction-y a concept.
But it is a mathematical, I mean, I guess there's a difference, again, between mathematical possibility and a mathematical probability. And what is decidability? Am I getting that word right? It stuck with me when I was reading the book earlier today. decidability. Isn't that a word in one of the theorems?
Yeah, there's something called Gödel's theorem, which I think you might be hitting on.
Of decidability. What's decidability?
Well, it has to do with that they've shown that within a math system that you can get these propositions that can't be proved or they can't be disproved. Their basic axioms in math can give rise to contradictions. So, in other words, math is somehow not complete. There's all these paradoxes can arise. It makes mathematics a lot more complex than they used to think before this was all discovered and theorized.
Well, all right, but then let me go back to the God thing. There's a lot of interesting work in the Bible, for example, on what some people would call numerology, but other people call gematria. But where the sort of the use of numbers in explaining the divine, and I often wonder sometimes whether it is that something we created, or as you talk about in the book, is that just something we discovered?
Well, a lot of people through time are almost had a gave divinity to numbers. I talk about the Pythagoreans; they actually almost worshipped numbers and thought they had a life of their own. But I do think that we are discovering the mathematics, because mathematics makes so much predictions, and you can actually take mathematics in one area that describes some area of physics, then take it to another area, and it fits so well that I think it's telling us something about the nature of reality. It's not that we're just, you know, we're inventing the notation for mathematics, but I think we're tapping into some deeper reality when we're talking about mathematics.
Yeah, and I would say that in a way that's how, I guess, mathematics relates to me to understanding the divine, because to understand the divine is to understand the infinite, all right, of what was, what is, and what shall always be. And if that's true, it's all, I was raised believing that, you know, we didn't invent 2 + 2 = 4. 2 + 2 = 4 before we ever came up with it. And it would, even if we forgot, we had sort of this mass, you know, hypnosis, and we forgot what 2 + 2 equaled, it would still equal 4. It just, we would have to rediscover it.
I feel as you do, that we're discovering it, and aliens on other worlds would probably discover similar truths, similar formulas. And speaking about God, I looked at it this way. If you look at a monkey's brain and a human brain, they're not all that different, but think of all the thoughts we can think that a monkey can't think. We can understand calculus and black holes and symbolic logic and poetry. Then again, there's probably a lot of facets of the universe that we can never think about because we're limited by our 3-pound massive brain. And it's at this interface of what we can know and what we can never really know that some may liken to the divine or to God.
What's the prisoner's dilemma?
The prisoner's dilemma is one of those other, also, you know, very interesting dilemmas that arose in the 1950s. So it's one of these non-zero-sum games where one person's victory is not the other's defeat. It's a little complicated, like the Newcomb's paradox, but it has to do with you have two prisoners, and they're separated in a jail, let's say, and if neither confesses to a crime, they get minimal sentences. But if one confesses and the other doesn't, the confessor just goes free. And the dilemma is, what will the people do? Basically, if they both don't confess, they get a very minimal sentence and they should do it. But at the last minute, one may decide, I'll confess and I'll go free. And it's a very twisted dilemma that people and mathematicians have actually thought about since the 1950s.
Well, it seems very relevant. That's why I brought it up. It almost seems like actually a dilemma that we live with in the news all the time when two people are arrested in a conspiracy for the same crime. Well, you get an idea. This has been a lot of fun. So thank you, Cliff, for putting up with all of my questions. And we'll get into a couple more because we never got to Super Egg. And I think Super Egg is super cool. And the and then a couple other the things that are in the book, the math book. What are your math questions or your observations, the patterns you see, and how can it help? Coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.